For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so Obadiah, main theme, and maybe why it's not such a popular teaching topic, is judgment, the judgment of God. This whole book is a meditation on God's judgment. Not popular, obviously. I think in an age of tolerance like we live in today, the idea that God would move in judgment because he's angry at sin, I think a lot of people would say, well, I'm not sure I'm really into a God that's that way. He's a holy God, right? How can he be angry all the time? And I think one reason this may be difficult for people to grasp is that there's a difference between our anger and God's anger. There really is. You know, when we get angry, it's often driven by selfishness, maybe petty jealousy. I think about the things that make my that drive my anger. Often it's arbitrary. I can think of a lot of times when I've expressed my anger, it's been uncontrolled, malicious, designed to hurt. A lot of some of the darker sides of our nature are expressed in anger. Some of the things we regret more than anything else in our life have been connected to anger. And I know from my own personal experience, truth be told, some of my most angry episodes are because my pride has been pricked and my pride has been wounded. And so one thing we got to realize when we talk about judgment or God moving in anger against sin is that his anger isn't tainted by those terrible things I just mentioned. It's not pricked by wounded pride. It's not driven by selfish ambition or maliciousness. Here's what God's anger is. God's anger is unmitigated hostility or antagonism towards sin and its damaging effects. That's what God's anger is. God will never sign a peace treaty with sin. He'll never compromise it. He will always, with every ounce of his strength, stand opposed to sin and its consequences. And so when we read about the judgment of God, that's what we're seeing unfold, is God moving against what he hates, and what he hates is sin. And you know, when you think about this then, the concept of judgment, I think it's both comforting and terrifying. It's comforting because, you know, some things happen in this world, and people get away with things in this world that do anger us. You know, some of us are trying to help out with reducing sex trafficking in Ohio. And I'll tell you, a lot of sex traffickers never get caught. And the stuff they do to kids that they get caught up in their system, it makes me angry, and it makes God angry. And I am comforted to know that there's a God out there who will move in judgment, that who will hold people like that accountable. It is comforting. But God's judgment is also terrifying because, you know, as we start to read through this book of Obadiah and you read through other parts of the Bible, you start to realize some of the things that anger God are things that I've done. That this isn't just about other people. I may have some culpability here. And so this is the human experience. We wrestle with the comfort and the terror of God's judgment, and we're going to wrestle with it all the way through this book. So let's go ahead and dive in and do that. Let's start in verse 1. Oh, before we get into this, just so you get kind of the overall framework. The way this book is set up, it's really simple. Obadiah talks about why God judges. Why does God judge? He'll answer that question. Then he explains how God does it, and then he repeats that twice. He'll go through those two questions twice, and then he finishes up this 21-verse book with how we should respond to God's judgment. It's a super simple book to follow. So we're just going to follow the text and go right through these questions. All right, so let's read this. Obadiah, verse 1, the vision of Obadiah. And by the way, we have no idea who this guy was. We know nothing about him. There are 12 Obadiahs in the Bible. We think this Obadiah was a prophet who lived in the 500s BC. That's about all we know. He says, the vision of Obadiah, thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We've heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations, saying, arise and let us rise up against her for battle. Okay, so the specific focus of God's judgment in this book is this country, Edom. There's this message from God, and it's concerning Edom. What God has done is he's summoning the nations to come and utterly destroy this country. That's what the whole book's about. Now, if you look on a map, Israel is kind of in the middle there, and Judah. And then below that, below the Dead Sea, a little south and east, is the kingdom of Edom. Now, Edom was a desert, kind of a desert wasteland with some well-watered urban centers, often surrounded by mountain strongholds. This is one of their most famous urban centers, a place called Salah in Aramaic, which means rock, which is fitting because it's right in the middle of a pile of huge rocks. It later became called Petra, which is just the Greek word for rock. And you can go visit some of these urban centers today. They are in impregnable, very difficult to reach mountain fortresses. There's no other way to describe it. There's a picture inside of Petra. You could protect these urban areas with a really small force. They're kind of like the Switzerland of the Middle East. You know, just often protected from warfare because they were just that inaccessible. All right, so why does God want to judge this country? Let's read about what happens. It says, God says, behold, I'm going to make you small among the nations. You'll be greatly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you. You who dwell in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, you who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Though you ascend as high as the eagle, and though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord. All right, so what's the problem here? The pride in their heart, their mistaken impression that they're invincible. It's pride. That's what God's angry about. That's why God is going to move in judgment. They ask, as they sit there in their lofty mountain fortress, who's going to bring me down? Who could ever bring this country down? And God responds, I will. I will bring you crashing down. I'm going to take care of you and your pride. So this is what's moved God to anger throughout this whole episode. So you look at this. How do we recognize pride? I think it's kind of easy to see in Edom. You know, in Edom we have this group of people up in their mountain fortresses, looking down from on high, taunting God himself, saying, you know, who's going to dislodge me from this position? Maybe you've heard the phrase, he who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Have you heard that before? It's repeated throughout the Bible. God determines to make this country of Edom a physical embodiment of that spiritual principle. They will be his object lesson. And throughout the Old Testament, that's exactly what they are. A prideful country that God's going to bring down. So that's how they're proud. How do we recognize our pride? Well, it's a little more subtle, but we see it here with them. You know, they took security in their mountain fortresses. That was one way their pride was exhibited. What about us? We don't have mountain fortresses, at least I don't think you do. We have other ways of, kind of securing ourselves against anything that might come our way. We could think, I've got an unassailable reputation. My life might be ruined, but no one can take my reputation away. When you think about the guy in Luke 12. The wealthy farmer who stockpiled his silos full of grain. They were so full, he had everything he would need. And he sat on his back porch, and he was like, I can take my rest. I've got it covered. Remember what happens? God cruises in and says, you fool. This very night, your soul is required of you. Now who's going to use all that grain you've stockpiled? So we could take pride or security in our reputation, or sense of security in our wealth, or maybe some worldview we've come up with that's boxed out God. We do the very same kind of thing. And kind of hand in hand with this, and something that Obadiah zeroes in on, is wherever there's pride, there's its sister self-deception. They always go hand in hand. Look what he says. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who dwell in the clefts of the rock. I mean, how did they perceive themselves? They actually, in their own mind, their perception was, we've set our nest among the stars. We're unreachable. That's what they thought. What was the truth? The truth was they were just another country in a long line of countries that have come and gone. Proud rulers that had their window, but then eventually collapsed, just like every other human empire that's ever existed. They were self-deceived. You know, and we get the same way. I've been through stretches where I've felt good about the degrees I've had. Things are going well at work. I've felt physically healthy. I've got money coming in. I've got family with money in case my money doesn't come in. And you're just like, things are good. And you start to feel that sense of invincibility. It doesn't last forever, but we feel it. But what does God say? God says that's not true. He says in Revelation, how could I forget this? Why do I have a picture of Iron Man out of nowhere? This is our ideal, right? These movies, these superhero movies are so popular. Why? This is our proud fantasy, right? An invincible superhero, an utter master of his environment, totally able to handle everything that comes our way. This is the way we'd like to perceive ourselves. We never come out and say it. And our boat gets rocked, but this, if we could be this, this is what we would want to do. God says, no, you say I'm rich. You've become wealthy and you have no need of nothing, and you don't know that you're actually wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. You are one giant asteroid, one nuclear terrorist, one terrible illness or life tragedy away from utter ruin. That's where we're at. That's what's true. Makes you wonder, you know, do we really get the fact that we're proud? Do we really see it? Look what James says. He says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we'll go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit, yet you don't know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we'll live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. You know, if somebody stole something, I think we'd instantly recognize that, ooh, that's bad. They stole. But what about this? This is just people, you know, making plans, going places, doing business. What's so wrong about that? James says, done without regard for God, living as if we didn't depend on him for every breath we took, is pride, and it's sinful. It's not just sinful, he says, it's evil. So that's, that's pride. And I'll tell you, there's plenty of pride to go around. We live in a proud, proud culture. All right, so how does God deal with prideful people like this? Well, his judgment, when he does move in judgment, is complete. He says in verse 5, if thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you'll be ruined. Would they not steal only until they had enough? You ever been robbed? A people that I haven't, thank goodness. But a lot of times people who've had their house robbed will tell you, they took this, but I can't believe they didn't take that. You know, why did they leave this valuable thing over here? And so, Obadiah is saying is, look, when a robber comes, they may leave a few things. But when God comes, he will clean you out. There'll be nothing left. You know, it says, if grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave some gleanings? Oh, how Esau will be ransacked and his hidden treasures searched out. You know, you go clean out some grapes from a vineyard, you harvest a crop. There's always something left. Not when God judges. His judgment is complete. The other thing about God's judgment is it's inescapable. Nothing can protect us from it. Nothing that at least we can come up with. It says, all the men allied with you, Edom, you will send you forth to the border. The men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. They who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. There's no understanding in him. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountain of Esau? Then your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman, so that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter. Who would the Edomites turn to for help? They'd turn to their allies, right? To the people they're at peace with. But what happens? No. Those folks will deceive them. Maybe they're friends that they share bread with, or they're wise men, or they're warriors, they're mighty men. God says, no. None of those talented people, despite all of their strengths, will be able to do anything for you on the day of God's judgment. It's inescapable. And again, you know, we don't maybe have those kind of resources to protect us against judgment, but we do have our sayings. And I think a lot of what I was trying to think, what do we really lean on? I think we lean on just these things we say to ourselves. I like to think of God as a God who doesn't judge. You've probably heard people say that. And I'd like to think of God as a God who doesn't judge. Unfortunately, as a reader of the Bible, that's not an option. And here's something you got to ask yourself. Will a simple aversion to the idea of a judging God protect us from his judgment? You know, in every other area of life, whether it's an F5 tornado or a coming troops, the size of a troop that's about to attack your country, we have to deal with reality as it is, not reality as we'd like it to be. If there is a God out there, and there is, he's who he says he is, not who we think he is. And there's good reason to believe the Bible, and the Bible's telling us God judges, regardless of what we think. Another thing we hear people say, and I think people, maybe they wouldn't even say it, but they kind of walk around hoping this, is I'm basically a good person. You know, I try to take care of the people in my life. I've tried to avoid some of the more serious sins that people get into. I'm basically a good person. Hopefully, when I'm with God on that day, I'll be okay. Well, according to Isaiah 64, verse 6, we're unclean in God's eyes. That even our best deeds are like filthy menstrual rags. That's the literal description. It's like, in God's eyes, we're woefully, constitutionally sinful and never going to be worthy of being in his presence on our own merits. Nobody will escape God's judgment on the merit of their good behavior. That is clearly taught in the Bible. So these things are no escape. As much as we'd like to escape, there's no escape from judgment. Okay, so remember how I said he starts with why does God judge? And then he explains how, and then we're going to go back again, why and how. Then we'll do that third question. Why does God judge? Notice he says right there, because of the violence, Edom, that you did to your close relatives in Israel, you'll be filled with shame and destroyed forever. When they were invaded, you stood aloof, refusing to help them. Foreign invaders carried off their wealth and cast lots to divide up Jerusalem. But you acted like one of Israel's enemies. You shouldn't have gloated when they exiled your relatives to distant lands. You shouldn't have rejoiced when the people of Judah suffered such misfortune. You should not have spoken arrogantly in that terrible time of trouble. Now, it's hard to pin down what specific historic situation is being referred to, but most people believe this is a reference to an event that happened in 586 BC. The Babylonians came in and they leveled Jerusalem. And when that happened, Jewish refugees fled south toward Edom. And when they headed south to seek safe haven, instead of finding protection, They found gloating. They found people rejoicing over their demise, people speaking arrogantly against them. It says in verse 13 to the Edomites, you shouldn't have plundered the land of Israel when they were suffering such calamity. These guys were like looters picking up, you know, people's belongings after a hurricane. They just preyed on the Jews in the smoking ruins of Jerusalem. It's wicked. He goes on, he says, you shouldn't have gloated over their destruction when they were suffering. You shouldn't have seized their wealth when they were suffering. You shouldn't have stood at the crossroads. You know, those narrow passages that are access to Edom. They stood there and killed the fleeing Jewish refugees. He's like, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have killed those who tried to escape. You should not have captured the survivors and handed them over. They took these folks and sent them into slavery. You know, and the thing that's really galling about this, particularly bad, is they did it to their relatives. The Edomites, they were close to the Jews. Think about this just real quick. Edom is descendant from a guy named Esau. He was mentioned in Genesis. Famous guy in the Bible. The Israelites, they descend from a guy named Jacob. And a long time ago, those two were brothers. Esau and Jacob were family. And so the Edomites, if anybody was close to Israel, if anybody could have been relied on to step in and help, it should have been Edom, Israel's brother. But no, that's not what happens. And so what we're reading about in this list here, you know, if you wanted to, you know, capture it in a single word, it's cruelty. It's cruelty. It's indifference. Not just indifference, it's preying on people. That moves God to judge. It deeply angers God. You know, I look at this list and you can't miss the repeated you should not haves. The thing that's really sobering for me about this is I have to admit, I'm guilty of a lot of these should not haves. Have I ever, like in a work environment, quietly rejoiced because a competitor faced a calamity? Have I ever done that before? Sadly, yes. Have I ever spoken arrogantly or took some sense of self-worth because somebody else I know wasn't doing as well as me? You know, Christ is really clear in the Gospels. It's not just what we do, it's these thoughts that we have that make us culpable. Have I ever been indifferent and stockpiled wealth when other people desperately needed it? I think I'd have to say I have. I think if we're honest, I think all of us would have to say we have. We've got some should-not-haves in our background. This is the verdict of the Bible. The Bible teaches both Jews and Greeks. That means all humanity are under sin. As it's written, there's none righteous, not even one. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their paths. The path of peace they haven't known. There's no fear of God before their eyes. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. You know, this is one of those points in the book where you can start to realize why verses from Obadiah aren't on refrigerator magnets, and they don't put them on, you know, precious moments figurines and things like this. This is a rough message. And it's God's diagnosis about all of us. It's just the way it is. This is how God sees it. Who can deny it? So what does God do with cruel people, prideful, cruel people? Now, here's a little twist. This is where the book begins to get even more disturbing. He's talking about the judgment of Edom, but now he says, for the day of the Lord is upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your reprisal shall return upon your own head. For as you drank on my holy mountain, so shall all the nations drink continually. Yes, they'll drink and swallow, and they shall be as though they had never been. See that there? Who's this day of judgment for? Is it just for Edom? No. It's for everybody. It's for all the nations. He says further down, all the nations, every single person will drink of God's judgment. God's judgment is for everyone, not just for Edom. It's something that's on all of our calendars. It's in our future. You know, this reference to drinking is a common theme in the Bible too. The Bible describes God's judgment as like a chalice or a cup filled with his, like I said, antagonism and anger towards sin. You know, and he's saying every wicked person that's ever lived is going to be drinking to the dregs that cup of judgment. What's cool about this, though, I guess the positive thing about this is all the way up to this point in this book, there's been nowhere to turn. Don't you feel kind of boxed in? I feel like I'm in a box canyon right now with nowhere to go. Fortunately, there is a way through here, which is what we get into next. How should we respond to God's judgment? All right, boy, that's a lot to read. I'm not going to read all of it at once. He says to begin in verse 17, on Mount Zion there will be deliverance and there shall be holiness. Let's just stop right there. On Mount Zion there will be deliverance. You know, up till now in the book there has been no deliverance. Finally, it seems like we have a way of escape. And the first thing we're being told to do here is to look for deliverance on Mount Zion. Now, try to stay with me on this. This will take a little concentration. In the Bible, Mount Zion stands for Jerusalem and specifically for the mountain where the temple was built. And in the Old Testament, for centuries, there are threads of prophecies predicting that on Mount Zion, in Jerusalem, on the Temple Mount, there will be deliverance from judgment that God provides. And it'll happen in two different ways, but through one person. According to the Bible, on Mount Zion, this man called the Messiah will come and provide deliverance. And he'll provide deliverance both by drinking that cup of judgment, being a sacrifice, and then by coming back as a king and saving God's people and restoring his rule. Remember, as Jesus was being talked to by the disciples and they're trying to persuade him, you don't need to die. You don't have to subject yourself to this. Do you remember what Christ said? He said, no. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? Jesus said, I came here to drink that cup. The cup that Obadiah mentions that's swirling with the wrath of God. Jesus said, my job as the Messiah is to go to Mount Zion and drink this dry. And that's what he did on the cross. When he died on the cross, Jesus Christ drank God's judgment all the way down. That's why Jesus was crucified. He was punished for us in our place. Visualize yourself sitting at a table, sitting in front of a cup of judgment and contemplating, I'm worthy of this and God says I have to drink it. And then imagine Jesus sitting next to you and sliding that cup of judgment down to himself and drinking it instead. That's what Jesus did on the cross. He drained the cup of God's wrath, and by doing so directed it away from you and onto himself. And so what's deliverance for us? We can look to Mount Zion. We can look to Christ's sacrifice, acknowledge it, and say, Jesus, I could never merit my acceptance before you. I'll never do enough good deeds. My only deliverance is to look to you to drink this cup for me. That's what it means to be a Christian. And that is the only way out of this dilemma that we're in. Now, the other thing that happens in Mount Zion, and this is really the focus of this whole passage, 17 through 21, is that God is going to come and deliver his people. It says, saviors will come to Mount Zion. And that's probably God and his angels will come to Mount Zion to judge the mountains of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. The Bible also says that after coming a first time to save us from sin, God will come again. The Messiah will come again and establish his kingdom. Jesus will rule from the throne of David on Mount Zion over all those nations, including Edom, all the nations of the world. And what we'll see at that day is what I would call a reversal of fortune, which we'll get to in a minute. But anyhow, so the second aspect of this looking to deliverance, looking to Mount Zion for deliverance, is God will set up his kingdom. And if you're a believer here today, this is in your future. Jesus Christ is going to rule the world from Jerusalem. That's a promise in the Bible. God will set up his eternal kingdom, and you will be part of it. That's on our, again, that's another thing on our calendar. The question is, how do we view that day? This is how some people view it. You know, well, that's just great. Jesus is coming. This is kind of a mocking way to look at the return of the Messiah to reign. It's also, you know, it's also the way we feel when someone who's annoying is coming by and we want to just kind of stay out of their way. Jesus is coming. Just find something to do so he doesn't pester you. And I, you know, what about you? You're a Christian. You're going to spend eternity under God's rule. How do you feel about that? Is that something you long for and look to as a source of deliverance? Or is it something that we're kind of reluctantly compliant with? I think when I think about this, it helps to compare my life to a house with a lot of rooms. You know, there are some parts of my life, like, you know, I give my money financially. I'm willing to share time to help people. I'm willing to come up here and do this. Some rooms in my life are open to God, and I feel like he's kind of ruling there. But there are other parts of my life that are boxed off and closed off. For some people, it might be time. Like, I'm willing to do a lot, but don't start crimping my schedule because I've got other things I need to do. Or it might be being willing to take input from somebody that sees that we're going off track. Some of us have whole wings of our life that are not accessible to God. Right, so how would I know? Am I the kind of person that's going to welcome the king when he comes? Well, am I the kind of person who's thrown every door of my life open to his rule? That's what it would look like, to be the kind of person that invites God to come in and rule our lives because we see that as deliverance, not a drag, but the best thing that we could do because God's good and because he loves us. Okay, so that's one way to look at this this coming judgment. One way to react. The other way is to expect a reversal of fortune. If you look here, there's a lot more in this text. Before I get into it, when I say a reversal of fortune, what I'm talking about is an unexpected change in your situation, either from good to bad or bad to good. It's like when you're racing through traffic trying to get to the airport because you want to catch your flight, and you finally get to your gate, and you realize, oh, crap. This is the right gate number, but the wrong terminal, right? That's a reversal of fortune. Or when you take a test in a class at Ohio State and you fail it, and then like two-thirds of the way through the quarter, you think, I'm doomed, I failed that test. Teacher says, I'm going to throw out your lowest midterm score. That's a reversal of fortune, right? It's like, wow, I walked in here thinking I was doomed. I think there's hope now. Same type of thing happens on the day of judgment. According to God, there will be this topsy-turvy reversal of fortune. Look what he says. He says the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. Now, where is Israel? Israel's a smoking ruin. Its people are exiled. Some of them are being enslaved. Their possessions have been ripped away from them. What's going to happen on the day of God's judgment? The house of Jacob will repossess their possessions. They will possess the land. And what about vaunted Esau, Edom? That, you know, secure in their mountain fortresses, well, they'll be stubble and they'll be burned up. He goes on and he says, you know, the house of Jacob will be a fire, the house of Joseph a flame, the house of Esau will be a stubble. They'll kindle and devour them. No survival will remain of the house of Esau. The Lord has spoken. The south will possess the mountains of Esau. The lowland will possess Philistia. They shall possess the fields of Ephraim, the fields of Samaria, and Benjamin will possess Gilead. What all these place names, the big point is, dispossessed Israel will repossess her land, and vaunted, exalted Edom will be utterly destroyed. A total reversal of fortune. The captives of this host of the children of Israel, they'll possess the land of the Canaanites as far as Zarephath. The captives of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad shall possess the cities of the south. You know, the exiled ones will be the ones who have their place again in the land. So when you think about this, what's this reversal of fortune going to look like for us? I think what we'll see is there'll be a lot of people on the day of judgment who thought that they were good with God, who thought that they had everything in place, and they will be stunned to find out that God's going to judge them. This is something the Bible talks about and something we should consider. Anybody who thinks they can rely on anything but God's deliverance will be sadly and shockingly disappointed on the day of judgment. It won't be your church attendance. It won't be your financial giving. It won't be all the good deeds you've done, all the cards you've written. None of that will save you. We have to utterly reject those things as a means to deliverance. If we haven't gone to God and God alone through Christ for deliverance, we will be stunned and shocked on the day of judgment. Of course, we're going to see other folks that God forgives and doesn't judge, and we're going to be stunned that He forgives them. People we never thought He would accept into His kingdom, He will welcome them with open arms. You know, some of you maybe feel like, you know, as I think about judgment and I review my should not haves, I realize there's no way. There's no way God would accept me. Well, I'll tell you what, there is a way. It's through Mount Zion. It's through Christ's sacrifice. It's through His willingness to drink the cup for you. You can, regardless of your background, begin a relationship with God right now by simply turning to Him and asking for it. Surprising, but true. Okay, couple final thoughts. So deliverance, like I've said, is on Zion, not available anywhere else. You know, and what this really gets down to is the antithesis of Edom's sin. It's not pride that God requires, it's humility. Look at this verse here. Isaiah says, I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble, to revive the heart of the contrite ones. This is an amazing verse. God has two addresses. He lives two places. He lives in a high and holy place, and He lives in the heart of the humble. Amazing, isn't it? God's willing to dwell not in the heart of the person who's never sinned, but in the heart of somebody who's had the humility to let Him drink His judgment for us. So that's it. This is kind of the message of the whole book in one verse. Though the Lord is exalted, He regards the lowly, but the haughty He knows from afar. So, okay. The book of Obadiah.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.